shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Tonight I want to talk about the first Christian nation. It's awfully hard to get much truth about early European history, because nearly all of it today is based on Roman sources. And the Romans were never noted for being fair or truthful in what they said about other nations. Now, Rome was founded, I forget the exact date, but it's approximately 750 B.C. Several hundred years before that, there was a westward movement of peoples with whom we are closely connected. As no doubt most of you know, some of the Israel people left Egypt before the Exodus. The tribe of Dan evidently had the ocean in their blood before they got settled in their land. Then you have the Zara half of the tribe of Judah. And there are some early records indicating that both of these, in part, left Egypt before the Exodus. The peoples of Dan moved on up the easterly end of the Mediterranean, and some of them settled Greece. The early history of Greece is a little difficult to pick out because practically, there was nobody there who bothered to write history. But definitely, you do not have the gradual development of a civilization. You have Greece suddenly populated by people who had come in bearing a high civilization. These early settlers, these Danoi, according to some of the Greek historians, had come from Egypt. Then you have the Zara half of the tribe of Judah, who also moved up the easterly end of the Mediterranean and had some settlements in Asia Minor. The city of Miletus became quite famous. In fact, it had a little empire of its own after a while, a number of colonies around the Mediterranean. They put out their own gold coinage, which, by the way, bore the lion of the tribe of Judah. Milesians were, at a later time, hired by Egypt as border guard soldiers. The Milesians established a considerable colony in Spain, and from there, some of them went on, landed in Ireland. And while you had a number of different related peoples getting into Ireland in separate migrations, the Milesians were among the dominant ones. In other words, they became ruling people in some of the tribes. And today, the Irish, whose names begin with Mac or with O, are descendants of the Milesians. But then there was another migration, not by sea, but by land. The earliest stages of it are not recorded in any history that we can find, so we can't place it exactly. But sometime in the second millennium B.C., that's earlier than 1000 B.C., the Celtic peoples coming from the east moved into Gaul, which is modern France. The land was named Gaul from its occupant. The Romans called it Gallia, and the Greeks called it Galatia. These Celtic peoples, especially the Gauls, behaved like the Israel people. They definitely refused to mix with any of the other races. Keeping the bloodline pure was enforced even by the death penalty for those who mongrelized. They had quite a high civilization. Now, your King James Version, many places, speaks of the metal brass. It is always wrong when it does so, because the ancient world didn't have any brass. Brass is an alloy of copper and zinc, and they didn't have the zinc mine. What they had was bronze, which is an alloy of copper and tin. Now, pure copper is too soft to be of much use. If you made a knife or an axe or a sword of it, it wouldn't hold its edge. When you alloy it with bronze, with tin to make bronze, you can get a reasonable degree of hardness. It becomes a very useful metal. And of course, for ornamental work, such as in Solomon's temple, the fact that it is fairly immune to corrosion and long-lasting made it especially valuable. Now, where did they get the tin? Today, there are two important sources of tin. There's some still produced from the British mines, so not much, are pretty well worked out, and some from Malaysia. And there is no hint that in these ancient days the Malaysian tin mines were worked at all. So the bronze known to the ancient world in Western Asia and around the Mediterranean was all based upon tin produced in Britain. Now in Britain, this was not as isolated as you would think. There was very heavy trade. Not only were they coming to get the raw tin to take back for use in their own countries, but British manufacturers, way back early, 1600 BC, were famous and highly desired in the Near East. For example, at Stonehenge, identifiably Egyptian beads, which were only produced during, I think, two dynasties in Egypt, and can be dated within a period, therefore, of less than 200 years. They have been found among the rubbish buried underground at Stonehenge. And similarly, British enameled jewelry has been found, well, for example, in old Gaza, in the ruins there, and can be dated as approximately 1500 BC. British swords were famous throughout the ancient world and highly desired. So you had a very brisk trade between Britain and the Near East. Therefore, you had a steady stream of Phoenicians and Greeks coming in here as traders, and the people of southern Britain who had contact with them, of course, not only learned the news of what went on in the eastern Mediterranean before it was very stale, but they also became familiar with their languages. Now, this same thing was true, of course, on the Mediterranean shoreline of Gaul. It's definitely known that in early times, many of the Gauls spoke not only Greek, but also Aramaic, in addition to their own Celtic language. Celtic, by the way, is the oldest living language. Now, one thing of importance, these Celtic people had the Druidic religion. Now, there isn't much known about it to these people who rely upon the Roman historians. In the first place, the Romans weren't interested, and in the second place, the Romans were hostile. The Druids believed in one God, and up to that time, the Israel people were the only ones who did, because all the other nations, the pagan nations, had a multitude of gods. Every city had its own particular god, besides worshiping some national gods, and just to be on the safe side, a few gods from other places. You remember, even among the Greeks, with their many gods, St. Paul also found in Athens the altar to the unknown god, so his feelings wouldn't be hurt. The Druids believed in the immortality of the soul, which was something astonishing to the Romans because, like the other pagans, they either believed that death was total extinction or else that the soul survived in a completely powerless form. It went to a place where bare existence was all that it had. There was no possibility of progress of any sort. There was no joy. They simply weren't quite extinguished. So the doctrine of the immortality of the soul is something the Romans commented on with some surprise. Their ethical and moral standards were as high as those of Christianity. And they said that following death, every man was going to be judged according to his life, and that the only way that he could escape condemnation was to be redeemed by the sacrifice made by a redeemer who would come in human form, be killed for no fault of his own, and by the sacrifice of his life would pay the price of the sins of the people he was redeeming. And they said that this Redeemer, who had not yet come, was named Jesus. From what you know by now of the Bible, you can see that this is Christianity indeed in its main doctrine. Now, in the Hebrew and Aramaic, the name of the one we wrongly call Jesus would be Yahshua. Yah, the shortened form of the name of Yahweh, God himself, and the other, the Shua part, derived from the Hebrew word meaning salvation. So the meaning of the combined word, Yah, saves. But in Greek, it was written with Greek letters corresponding to our English, I-E-S-O-U-S, and pronounced Jesus. Well, take off the final S, and your Greek Jesus and the Celtic Jesus are the same thing. Now, when they came on into Britain, they brought the Druidic religion, which probably was not as highly developed in Gaul as it became in Britain. Now, the slanders about the religion by Julius Caesar and some of the other Romans are, of course, obviously false. They told the same lies about the Druids that the Romans later told about the Christians, upon the basis that the only means of salvation for you is that the Redeemer die in your place. They said, well, these Druids, and later these Christians, practice human sacrifice. Then, since the Druids had what corresponded to our Christian communion, that in eating the flesh of a sacrifice victim and drinking the wine. They said you were receiving the symbolically the body and blood of the Redeemer sacrificed for you. And since the Redeemer was human, why, therefore, the Romans said, you see, they're cannibals also. That's the same story they told about the Christians. Now, the Druidic religion was held by the people in general. That didn't make them Druids. The Druids themselves were the priests of this religion. We don't know so much about the Druidic universities in Gaul, but we do know quite a bit about it in Britain. Druidism had been established in Britain as early as 1800 BC under Hugh the Darn, Hugh the Mighty. Some of the legends say he was the builder of Stonehenge. We know that there were over 40 universities, Druid universities, in Britain at the time of the Roman invasion of Britain. At varying times, the number of students at these universities, was the total of them, ranged from 40 to 60,000. The course of study took 20 years. And when you graduated from a Druid university, you had all the knowledge that existed in your day. It covered all science that was known in those days: mathematics, astronomy, literature and languages, architecture, economics, political science, that is, government, and anybody who finished that course was able to take his part in any of the nation's activities. As to other settlements, as I say, the people of the Zara portion of Judah are believed, on reasonably good evidence, to have been the ones who settled the city of Troy, the one that was destroyed, and that was recorded in Homer's epic. The grandson of one of the great leaders of those Trojans, Brutus the Trojan, was a party of his companions, moved west by ship to the Mediterranean, paused briefly in southern Italy, went on, and this is accepted historic fact, he founded the city of London in 1020 B.C. That's 270 years before the city of Rome was founded. Now, as I mentioned before, these people were in constant contact with traders from the Mediterranean region, so they were familiar with other cultures beside their own. Now, Julius Caesar landed expeditions in Britain in 55 and 54 B.C., and in writing of them, he mentioned that the native Britons, the Druids, while they had their own Celtic language, that in their commercial transactions, they wrote in the Greek language. So these were no barbarians. After his unsuccessful invasion in 55 B.C., he hung on for about 3 weeks and then got out. He wrote with amazement of these British universities, their fine architecture, the number of populous cities, and the substantial population of the British, their high culture, and their religion. So now, with that understanding of what you had in Gaul and the Britain. Now we can get some history from the east end of the Mediterranean. You know, of course, about the ministry of Christ and the opposition it met with among the Jews, till they finally murdered him, and their hatred was that which only Jews would be capable of. You remember the Bible tells you, I believe it's in the Gospel of Mark, that not only did they want to kill Christ, but they also plotted to kill Lazarus. Lazarus was the man brought back to life after he died by Jesus Christ. And because that miracle was causing a lot of people to believe in Christ, the Jews plotted to murder Lazarus. It has been pretty definitely established that Joseph of Arimathea was an uncle of Jesus Christ. You get only a certain amount of mention of him, not very much in the scripture, but some of the early Christian writers have added more about him. He was quite a wealthy man. He was owner of some tin mines in Cornwall. He owned a number of ships in which he conducted the importation of tin from Britain. It is of record that he was a Roman official, a decurio. In fact, some of the early writings speak of him as nobilis decurio. Now, a decurio was a Roman official in charge of mines. And Joseph of Arimathea was one of high standing. He was a member of the Roman Provincial Senate, as well as a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin. That accounts for the fact that he was able to give some protection against the hatred of the Jews. Now, he alone dared go to Pontius Pilate to claim the body of Jesus Christ for burial after the crucifixion. Theoretically, any near relative of one officially executed could come immediately after his death and claim the body for burial, that under both Jewish and Roman law. But anyone who had dared to do so, to claim that from the Jewish Sanhedrin, would undoubtedly have been murdered. Joseph of Arimathea had the standing to go direct to Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, ignoring the Sanhedrin, and claim the body. And it was in his tomb that the body of Christ was laid and from which he was resurrected. After the death of Christ, Jewish hatred was, of course, as strong as before, and the persecution of anyone who admitted he was a Christian was, of course, very intense. You read in your Bible of how Saul of Tarsus, who became the Apostle Paul, was among those who hunted down the Christians and had them imprisoned or murdered. And after they'd been hunted down or driven into exile in Palestine, Saul was on his way as far as Damascus in Syria to try to have them arrested and brought to Jerusalem for imprisonment or execution. At the time when he was converted, and God had to knock him down to get him to pay attention then, remember. It wasn't long after the crucifixion that the Apostle Stephen was murdered, the first of the Christian martyrs. And it continued just getting constantly worse. Now, the early Christian writers, many of them, agree that by the year 36 AD, practically all Christians were scattered out of Judea by the persecution. In fact, it was in the year 35 that Saul was on his way to Damascus when God brought him to his senses. Now, the Emperor Tiberius, who reigned as emperor from the years 14 to 37 A.D., Tiberius, of course, wanted no disturbances at all in his empire, and he was having trouble enough with the Jews as it was, and the furore arising between the Jews and the Christians, he decided should be stamped out. Also, the Gauls were not limited to France. Some of them had spilled over the Alps down into northern Italy, and they were troublesome there too. So by edict, Emperor Tiberius established the death penalty for believing either Christianity or Druidism. Now, up to the time of crucifixion, the followers of Christ had a little protection against the Jews. Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, knew and despised utterly the Jews. And you notice that when the Jews came to him with their lies against Christ, he was not deceived. However, Pontius Pilate was a pretty slippery character himself. He had been one of the parties to a conspiracy to assassinate Tiberius. It fell through, and Tiberius never discovered, Tiberius the emperor never discovered that Pontius Pilate was one of the members of the plot. But the Jewish high priest, Caiaphas, knew of this. And with this, he blackmailed Pontius Pilate. Now, the Bible records the trial of Jesus Christ before Pilate. And four separate times, Pilate found him not guilty. He said, "I find in him no fault at all." And yet, under pressure from Caiaphas, he gave in and said, "All right, I know he's innocent, but has him killed." But now, when Tiberius issued this edict, making a death penalty for believing in Christianity, there was no protection at all within the Roman Empire for Christians. Many reliable authorities among the early Christian writers say that in 36 A.D., Joseph of Arimathea, with a party of 12 other Christians, were set adrift in a boat in the Mediterranean, towed out to sea and set adrift, no oars, no sails. And that eventually the party reached Marseille on the French Mediterranean coast. Now, whether a ship came along and picked them up or whether it was a miraculous wind and tide that sent them there, you can take your own choice. There's no record of how it was done. But the fact that they got there is quite definite because of historical records. The party included Mary Magdalene, Martha, her maid Marcella, Lazarus, Maximin, a man who had been blind and Jesus Christ restored his sight, the apostles Philip and James, Mary, the wife of Cleopas, and Mary, the mother of Jesus. Cardinal Baronius, who was the greatest church historian of the Catholic Church, lived in the 16th century. He quotes from various authentic sources on this among the recognized historians of the early Christian period. Isidore, Archbishop of Seville, from 600 to 636 A.D., Julian, Archbishop of Toledo, 680 to 690 A.D., Procopius, Bishop of Lisieux in France, A.D. 825 to 851, are among those who have recorded these facts in their church history. Well, these early church historians record that soon after the arrival of Joseph of Arimathea and St. Philip and the rest of the party at Marseilles, a delegation of Druids from Britain came over and asked them to come to Britain and teach Christianity there. Remember now that basically Druidism had Christianity. Like the Old Testament, and I've talked to you before about this, all the Old Testament is simply symbolic of the coming of Christ, his sacrifice on the cross, his resurrection, and so on. But of course, since at that time he had not yet come, it looked to the future. Druidism, in other words, was the Old Testament. Now, they were expecting a Redeemer named Yeshu who would come and give his life to save them. He would be killed for no fault of his own to pay the penalty of their sins. Now, they'd already heard, remember, from the time of the crucifixion, variously dated from 30 to 33 A.D., from that time on, you had had uninterrupted voyages by the traders carrying this news. All this disturbance in Palestine, you can bet, was learned there. So, they had heard Yeshu had come and had been murdered, and they said, well, this is what we've been waiting for all this time. Now come and tell us about it. And it is of record that the Celtic peoples, who could not be induced to abandon their Druidic religion and accept Roman paganism, they were murdered literally by the millions, by the Romans, trying to stamp out Druidism. And they got nowhere. These people would not give up their religion. But they accepted Christianity with no argument, no trouble. Now, there were a great number of Christian martyrs in England through the centuries. Martyred first by the Roman military might, and later by Roman Catholicism, but only one Christian martyr in Britain who was put to death by these Celtic people. And that was only because they bitterly hated, of course, the Romans. And this man, having come out of the Roman Empire, they thought, well, here's another Roman trying to put something over on us, and they killed him before they found out who he was. Now, Roman attacks on Britain were no mere accident. Julius Caesar had gone into Gaul to conquer Gaul, and the Celtic people of Britain were sending troops to aid their fellow Celts in Gaul against the Roman armies. And so, the Romans sent a punitive expedition into Britain under Julius Caesar, starting in 55 B.C. and again in 54 B.C. And Roman attacks continued sporadically until the middle 300s A.D. And they never, contrary to what your school histories have told you, they never did actually conquer Britain. Well, Philip, the Apostle Philip, remained principally in Gaul, though he went to Britain on at least two occasions for a short time to see how things were getting along there. Philip was the apostle to Gaul, but he ordained Joseph of Arimathea as the apostle to Britain and sent him with his companions to start the church in Britain. Prince Arviragus, head of one of these Celtic Britain kingdoms, offered to give them land and protection against Roman persecution. Now, this Arviragus was the Prince of Cornwall. He was a cousin of Caradoc, the King of Wales, and it's interesting to note that the great King Arthur and the later Tudor kings of Egypt are descendants of Caradoc. The Romans corrupted the name to Caractacus, and you may have heard of him in your histories under that name.
The kings of what?
The Tudor kings of England.
Oh,
did I? Yeah, the Tudor kings of England were descended from Caradoc. Well, the attacks continued by the Romans, and the first defense against these continuing Roman attacks were led by Arviragus, King of Cornwall. The Emperor Claudius, in AD 42, again made an edict that the penalty for belief in either Druidism or Christianity would be death. And he sent the largest and best-equipped Roman army that had been raised to that date to conquer Britain. Now remember how wide the Roman Empire was. Rome had taken Greece, had taken Egypt, had taken Carthage and all the North African shore. They had taken Asia Minor. They had conquered far into Babylonia, and they didn't have much trouble. And here was this one little island out there, and they sent their biggest, best-equipped armies, led by their best generals, and for three centuries, they couldn't really conquer it. Well, after the first couple of battles, Caradoc, the King of Wales, joined Arviragus. Now you had not one nation of Britain, you had a number of small kingdoms. In other words, separate tribes, you might say, among them. Caradoc had been educated both in the Druid universities and to some extent at Rome. He was elected Pendragon, Commander-in-Chief. Now, he led them in 9 years of ceaseless warfare against the best Roman generals, and the Romans had little more than a toehold in Britain in all that time. Many of the Roman writers, Tacitus, Martial, Juvenal, and so on, record the reckless courage of these British warriors. They weren't afraid of these excellently trained, excellently equipped Roman legions. They simply swarmed over them and cut them to pieces. And their battle cry was the Druid motto, "The truth against the world." Like Julius Caesar, these other Roman writers said that when the Romans occasionally did defeat the British, instead of it dampening their spirits, it only increased the ardor with which they fought. Well, during this period, after the first 2 years of continued failure, the Emperor Claudius asked for a six-month armistice to discuss peace terms, and invited Caradoc and Arviragus to Rome. to try to negotiate a peace. Well, the Romans wanted to dictate terms of peace, and the British weren't having any. The Romans were going to stamp out Christianity, so they were not acceptable. But to show you what the Romans, in spite of the things they wrote about the British as savages and so on, what the Romans thought of them, and this is recorded Roman history now we're talking about. The Emperor Claudius offered his daughter, Venus Julia, in marriage to Arviragus, King of Cornwall, and they were married in Rome in the year 45 AD. Meantime, the chief Roman commander in Britain during this armistice was married to Gladys, the sister of Caradoc. Well, when the British refused to compromise on the religious issue, the war was resumed. So the Roman army then was led by the four ablest generals that Rome had. Aulus Plautius, Vespasian, who was later to become emperor, his son Titus, the man who destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70, and Geta. And they found themselves so swamped by the British resistance, they pleaded with Claudius for help, so that he came over with two more Roman legions, a squadron of elephants, and a large number of other auxiliary troops. Now, they did not defeat the British armies. By treachery, treason, Caradoc was betrayed to the Romans, and he and his immediate family were taken to Rome as prisoners. Now, usually, because no more bestial people have ever been known in human history than the Romans, usually prisoners were tortured to death under circumstances of extreme cruelty. Instead of this, Caradoc, who appeared before the Roman Senate, addressed them, by the way, in Latin, and gave a very beautiful speech. I don't have it copied here, but he aroused their admiration so that they required him to remain 7 years as a hostage in Rome and to swear that he would never, in the rest of his life, take up arms against Rome again. The other members of his family could remain with him there. But while Caradoc was not free to leave Rome during the 7 years, the other members could. And a couple of his sons went back to Britain, one of them becoming king in his place. They allowed Caradoc the income from his estates in Britain so he could live as befitted a nobleman. And they assigned him a palace. It was known as the Palatium Britannicum, the British Palace. While he was there, by the way, the daughter of Caradoc, Gladys, was adopted by the Emperor Claudius as his daughter. And she was married to Rufus Pudentius, a Roman senator, in the year 53. Now, Pudens was already a Christian convert. In the Epistles to the Romans, chapter 16, verse 13, Paul sends greetings to Rufus and to his mother and mine. Now, you remember Paul was a Roman citizen. He was born of Benjamite parents, and born in a Roman city and a Roman citizen by birth. His father died no great length of time after his birth, and his mother was married thereafter to to a Roman senator. So Rufus Pudens was a half-brother of Paul. They had the same mother, if not the same father. Now, the various Britons, Caradoc and his relatives, living at this British palace in Rome, were all that made possible the first Roman church. Because remember, all this time, Christianity was condemned by law. And only the fact that these were people of that importance and that influence enabled the meetings of the early Christians in Rome to take place at the British palace. The Romans still kept trying to conquer Britain. As I say, it went on until the middle 300s. It was broken by periodic armistices, and these invariably were under treaties which recognized the British as allies, not conquered subjects of the Romans. The British kings kept their authority and their privileges and liberties, which is something the Romans did not do to conquered lands. Another one of these Britons, in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 21, Paul speaks of Pudens, the same Rufus Pudens, and Linus. Now, Linus was another British prince who by this time was a Christian priest in Rome. Well, all this was in the 50s and 60s A.D. So even the existence of just a small church in Rome did not come as early as the existence of a Christian church in Britain, which began in the year 37 A.D. All church records, including the records of the Vatican itself, agree that the British church was established in the last year of the reign of the Emperor Tiberius, which was 37 A.D. Another indication of the degree of civilization of the British is this. Seneca, who had some reputation as a philosopher, an even greater reputation as a crook who made money any way he could, and as the richest man in Rome, Seneca loaned the equivalent of $10 million in our modern money to Prasutagus, the king of the British tribe of the Iceni. He loaned it to him on the security of the public buildings of the Iceni. Now, you try to get a loan of $10 million today on buildings, and you've got to have some pretty good buildings to get it on, don't you? And remember, $10 million then was equal to more than $100 million today in relative value. Now, by one of these periodic armistice treaties, the Romans had freedom of residence and travel within the domain of the Iceni and the Coronii tribes in Britain. Well, when Prasutagus, this king who borrowed the money, died, the Romans, they were predatory scoundrels, but then so were most other nations in that day. The Romans seized the opportunity now to treacherously attack the Iceni. They massacred many of them. There were horrible massacres, rapes, robberies. The Romans stole everything they could, occupied the lands and houses of the wealthy people and so on, and Queen Boadicea, the widow of Prasutagus, she roused the British and led the combined armies of at least four of these British kingdoms against the Romans in the year 60 A.D. And she did a remarkable job. Roman armies were defeated and destroyed just wholesale, to the point where some of the high Roman generals abandoned their armies and fled to Gaul for their lives. The Roman writer Tacitus reports that over 80,000 Roman soldiers were killed in this one war. London had been taken over by the Romans. It was a great commercial city under the Romans. And Boadicea with her armies attacked it, and the Roman records show that of the defenders, Roman soldiers and all, 40,000 were slaughtered there. Finally, in one battle, Boadicea and a few troops around her were cut off from the rest of the army. And thinking she was in danger of immediate capture by the Romans and knowing how she'd be treated by them, she committed suicide. Well, upon the death of her husband, Boadicea had been publicly flogged by the Romans, and her two daughters raped in public before her. So the Romans knew that during her lifetime there was no point in talking peace terms to her. But on her death, they sought peace terms. And it's interesting to note, the Roman historians themselves show that they restored all the confiscated properties to the Iceni, the debt to Seneca for this borrowed $10 million was canceled, and Rome paid a heavy indemnity. Does that sound like Romans dealing with a conquered people? Well, now let's sum this up. The first church in Britain started in 37 A.D. The first church in Rome during the 50s A.D. But the church in Rome got nowhere. Far from Rome being the helper of Christianity, until the Emperor Constantine, Rome was the greatest enemy of Christianity. Rome didn't even tolerate Christianity until 313 A.D., when Constantine had secured power as emperor by the sword and issued his edict of toleration. So Rome was definitely not a Christian nation. The first faint beginnings of what ultimately became the Catholic Church didn't start until long after the death of Constantine. But from 37 on, you had had in Britain, without a break, a Christian church. In all their furious attacks on Britain trying to stamp out Christianity, the Romans never penetrated as far as Glastonbury, where Joseph of Arimathea had set up his headquarters. They lost scores of thousands of troops trying to get there, but the Britons always turned them back. The trouble with so many of these topics I take for discussion is that they always dovetail around the edges with other things, each one of which would take one or two evenings to discuss in itself. And the Christian church in Britain, headquarters at Glastonbury, and the many missionaries they sent out into Ireland, into Scotland, into Gaul, into various places throughout the Roman Empire. That would be a whole evening's discussion in itself, so we won't go into that. But you had a thriving, uninterrupted Christian church in Britain from the year 37 A.D. on. Now, in the year 156 A.D., King Lucius, at a national council, officially proclaimed Britain to be a Christian nation. That is the first time in history that any nation ever adopted Christianity. Remember now, it was over 160 years after that before the Romans even tolerated it. And here Christianity was made the official religion of Britain in 156 A.D. Now, much as the Roman Catholic Church likes to claim to be first and most important in everything, the records of the Vatican show that all this is true. There have been a number of important church councils, and at these, as the delegates from the different nations came, there was, of course, a lot of jealousy over who would be recognized as more important than someone else. It depended, of course, upon how early Christianity had been accepted in the nation from which these delegates came. And in every instance, the delegates from Britain were officially recognized as coming from the first Christian church. Among these, the great ecclesiastical council at the city of Pisa in A.D. 1417, at Constance in A.D. 1419, at Siena in A.D. 1423. And in each of these cases, it was officially determined, based upon Vatican records, that the Christian church in Britain, founded by Joseph of Arimathea, was the first Christian church. You remember that in the reign of Henry VIII, Britain broke away from Roman Catholicism, which had been the official religion, and you had the English Reformation. During the time that the quarrel between King Henry VIII and the Pope was going on, leading up to the official break, an eminent Catholic official, Polydore Vergil, wrote at that time that the British Church was the first church to be, Christian church, to be established in any nation in the world. So, the first Christian nation, and the one which has been continuously Christian ever since, was Britain.
You have been listening to a message by the late Pastor Bertrand L. Compre from his sermon titled The First Christian Nation. If you would like a complete tape or CD of this talk, ask for it by name with the number 109 and send a donation to cover our costs and help with radio time. Thank you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.